the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the CBP, Canadian Bitcoiners podcast on the CBP Media Network. My name is Joey, and I'm actually joined by another Joe tonight. Joe Barbuto is going to be joining us from the Economic Long Wave. You know him from Twitter. He spoke at the Canadian conference as well, did a great presentation. We're going to talk about that presentation tonight and some other stuff as well. Before we get started, as you guys know, sponsored by two great companies. The first, EasyDNS. Mark and the team at EasyDNS have been outstanding for us. They'll be outstanding for you too, whether it's domain hosting, virtual private server stuff. So if you want to do a Nostr Relay, decentralized messaging app, obviously you guys all know about that. BTC Pay Server, decentralized way to take payments. You can't beat it. Don't get censored by the man. As well as stuff like email, other encryption services. If you need something and you're not sure about it and you think Mark might know, chances are he knows. Tell him we sent you or use the code CBP Media. You get 50% off. You can't get 50% off anywhere. I went to a bunch of places today. I'm going away this weekend. I didn't get 50% off anything that I bought, okay? So give those guys a look. And if you need any help, message Mark. He'll get back to you. He's always available, and we love him. So that's sponsor number one. Sponsor number two, Bull Bitcoin. Man, this day and age, as we will discuss tonight, governments are clamping down, man, making sure they know exactly what you got, and how much it tax you. Bull Bitcoin introduced, obviously, a few weeks ago, the only and best KYC-free, no-fee option in Canada. There is ATMs. You can get ATM KYC-free. You can go to your buddy in the street, right? It's one of those situations where he opens his coat and pulls out a couple open dives, maybe. I don't know. But Bull Bitcoin, sign up with our code CBP, so mission.bullbitcoin/CBP, mission.bullbitcoin.com/CBP. Deposit $100, you get 21 back, and then you can go to a post office to fund your account with cash. Give the clerk the money, take your QR code, load your account. Bull Bitcoin will have that money by the time you get home or close. I don't want to make any promises. And then they'll send that money, obviously, to you. It's non-custodial, so you're taking control of your own Bitcoin right away. We love those guys. We're happy to be on board with them. And they got a lot of stuff cooking that we're going to be happy to talk about here pretty soon. So while I was reading the ads, Joe dropped off. He's back now, though. Hold on. We got him. Good timing. Outstanding. Joe Barbuto is here. The Economic Long Wave. Joe, I got to say, I'm excited to hear you pronounce a multitude of names from the, maybe not so recent past that I would never take a crack at because I have not read about them, nor am I interested in trying to pronounce them in public. So first of all, sir, how are you doing tonight? Thanks for coming on.
Hey, listen, I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me. You can hear me okay? I'm using new equipment.
You sound great.
Okay, good.
Outstanding. So Joe, I invited you on because I think that there's a kind of a gap in the understanding of a lot of Bitcoiners. There's obviously this maximalist crowd that in terms of cryptocurrency, I'm a part of. You know, I only hold Bitcoin. I believe that's the thing that's going to be the sort of anchor of a lot of the financial future. And the other reason I invited you on is because as part of that gap in knowledge, I think that the long wave theory, the presentation you gave at the conference, some of the things I've heard you talk about in spaces on your YouTube channel, I think you can help people understand a little better what's happening now, how we got here, and what's going to happen next. So maybe before we start, give people a little background about who you are, how you stumbled on Long Wave, and maybe why it's important.
Sure. Totally by accident. If anybody would have told me 30 years ago I'd become a economic futurist or forecaster, I would have believed them. So my story, and I'll do this quickly because it's important. My story starts in 1989. Tuesday, February the 14th, my wife at the time, I actually proposed to her on that Tuesday. And real estate was hot and whatever. And that Sunday, we bought a condo. We were terrified of not being able to afford one because prices were constantly going up. And I didn't know it at the time. I bought it at the absolute top. We were married the following year, and then real estate went into a horrendous bear market, wiped us out financially. You know, I'm talking about a lackadaisical kind of now, but and it was a big lesson about what just happened. I'm curious by nature, so in the same year I started in the investment business, And I learned very quickly when I was in the investment business that it was really up to me. I was really responsible for the public's capital. And, you know, there were so many choices at the time. Now, today, there's even more, but I didn't know what to do. So after the losses, my common sense, well, why not find the best in the world? And I met John Templeton, Charles Brandes, Peter Kundal, who are the top value managers. And I love their principle was, you know, always looking for a bargain, never overpaying for stuff. And it was a great decade because it was a great education, seeing the collapse of real estate and all the speculation was gone. Nobody was interested in real estate. Mutual funds were hot. And I was learning the markets. And by the time 2000 came, I saw what was going to come. It was a little bit early and it prevented my clients getting wiped out. If actually I was holding a lot of cash. And I found that very quickly when I was in a meeting the next year with a lot of other advisors, you know, it was said, oh, bad markets, lost a lot of money. I said, hey, I protected my clients' capital and we did great. And I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised because they were taken aback that I actually saw what was coming. So I learned that lesson in 2008 to keep quiet about it. But I was a little bit early. And at that time, I was also learning technical analysis and I found out about the Dow theory. And then I stumbled onto the long wave forum. And I was an early adapter in technology. And so I was on the internet before it became even well known. And I found the long ways forum and it was fascinating. I mean, I met hedge fund managers, mutual fund managers, traders, economists, theorists, the smartest and the brightest people in the world. What an education. And I was on there for 95, 96, about 2012. And the education I got, and then I became good at it. One of the things I realized, I'm very good at extrapolating stuff and putting it all together because there were so many interpretations of the long wave. I had to figure out, oh, wait a sec, this person is only talking about the technology. This person's only talking about this aspect. So I said, why not put them together? And then I could have a model to project a future. And then I stumbled on when I learned technical analysis. His name is Martin Pring, who's the godfather. He writes a book on technical analysis, huge book. And he has a book that actually has a model for a long wave. And I thought, wow, this is fascinating. And it's on my website, one of the books I referenced to. So I said, well, why don't I build a Canadian one, you know, take all the information. And I was learning technical analysis and so forth. So I built it together. So this time when the top came in 2008, you know, I exited earlier and then watched the market collapse. And again, not surprisingly, because most people see bubbles are usually historians and there's ways to measure what's coming. So it was those two great performances that a lot of people knew who I was and they were liking my calls. And then later on, as I got really good at it, and 2012, I left the business because I saw what they were going to do. They were kicking the can down the road. And I saw that they were going to inflate real estate because it's the only leveraged asset that benefits from falling interest rates. And I said, I'm going to be holding the bag. I mean, I'm liable. It's not anybody else. So I left and I went on a personal journey, spiritual journey, because my health deteriorated. And I got that fixed, thank God. And I was studying more. And in 2014, I had an epiphany where everything made sense when I was studying energy and how energy moves through a medium, through a cycle. When I read that, everything made sense. And I went back to technical analysis and said, so you know what? This is all going to collapse. And it's because how things move through a cycle. No wonder Kondratiev was right and Schumpeter. But I knew that they were going to stretch it. And the furthest they could kick the can down the road was about 2020, 2024, was because the fall in interest rates, but the millennial demand, the tail end of the next real estate bubble, was going to peak around this time. And so I started posting And I knew to get my name out, I'd have to do it all for free. So I dumped all my charts, all my data, all my research on Twitter. And I started having a following. And people noticed that I was picking tops on, sorry, only because I follow the markets. But I did pick, you know, Bitcoin last year, renewable energy, but because I measure asset bubbles. But it's part of the model now, so some people want to trade it. But I know volatility and I can spot these cycles. So it's really a part of sustaining massive losses, working in the investment business 23 years. And I'm just curious how things work. It's a game for me, right? It's fascinating. And so right now I'm at a point in history where it's bittersweet for me in that here I am that I picked the top in real estate and the economy and so forth, but I know the ramifications to society. And I know, let me tell you, the people who are suffering right now, I know what you're going through. I totally get it because it's devastating to the family, your finances, everything you work for, your dreams, your aspirations. So I'm an expert in real estate. And you normally, I say I'm a student. But this is where I'm an expert because you have to experience bear markets to know what you're talking about. So seeing this opportunity was there were a lot of people who were going to not know what's going to happen. And plus, we're entering, which I'll end it here, we're entering a period called economic winter, where we'll be in a secular bear market. And it's a transformative phase, what's called creative destruction, where the whole system crumbles. And this causes civil unrest because what we built after World War II doesn't work and serve the economy. But we have this emerging decentralized renaissance, which is Bitcoin is part of it. And that's why they asked me to speak, that will drive the next long wave. But that might not happen until 2040. So the long wave is like a satellite view. It gives you a view of what's coming and it's to inform you. It's not to tell you what to do. You know, unlike Klaus Schwab, you know, who thinks that they know what's best for you. The long wave is, here's the information. You know what's best for you. And that in summation is what it is. So it's a summation of all the long wave books, history, crises, manias, panics, crashes, money management, and so forth. And my job is to simplify the process so people can understand that and benefit from it. And that is the long way. Oh, one more thing. There on my website, there's a picture. It's not me. It's Nikolai Kondratiev. And the reason why I want to mention this is the reason why we have the picture, because he's the one that discovered capitalism was this evolutionary system. And he forecasted to Stalin in the 20s that it was going to collapse and he was happy. But he said it was going to come back stronger than ever. Of course, Stalin didn't like that and sent him to the gulags in Siberia and he was shot and killed for discovering an evolutionary economic system. So that should tell you we should never trust politicians and with their agendas. So that's who that is. It's just a tip of the hat, a nod to this great economist who figured out how things work. And that's why I allude to the Kondratiev cycle or the economic long wave to help people understand what it is.
That's a great introduction. On this show, we often applaud when the guests roll downhill, and you just rolled downhill there. That was close to 11 minutes. I got to say, Joe, that's a lot of good information. And you said something there that it's a thread that I want to pull on. It's a thread that's important to me as a millennial and a lot of my colleagues, peers, about real estate and leverage and this great deleveraging that some of this long wave theory calls for and that I've heard you talk about and others as well. It's important for you know, people think about real estate, and I think that there's sort of a few camps, but the two that come to mind for me are the people who buy real estate to invest and the people who buy real estate to live. And I'm concerned about both camps because the people who buy real estate as an investment need to make money on that investment, of course. And as interest rates go up, this becomes more difficult. And, you know, people are kind of forced into precarious financial situations. And they have this in common with the people who buy real estate to live in as rates go up. They're forced into precarious financial situations. And this doesn't just influence, as you mentioned, kind of your mental health or your financial health. It affects important things, especially in a welfare state like Canada. It affects family formation. It shrinks the tax base. It forces sort of misguided, we'll say, to keep it kind, immigration policies and things of this nature. Talk to me about why they decided, the royal decided that real estate had to be the bubble to be inflated. And what other options maybe did they consider, or had they considered in the past?
You know, that's a great question. I think that, and I think a lot of people are going to disagree with what I have to say. I believe they're just trying to keep the system going. And politicians, and my father used to, my father used to never trust politicians. He was an Italian immigrant who came to this country under communist and fascist Italy. He was always grateful for this country, but he never trusted politicians. And I used to say, Dad, you know, you're wrong. This is Canada. Well, another lessons from Dad, right? He was right again. And when you understand the long wave, you see that politics is part of the cycle, and it's always reactionary, right? This is why I said this agenda is going to collapse. Mind you, it's going to cause a lot of pain, but it will collapse because it's not coming. Revolutions come from the bottom up, right? Bitcoin is a silent revolution, as people are saying. And that's how I see. So that's why I see it is it's the force. It's what the people want, not with these let's be honest, psychopath elitists that think that they know what's best for you, which is ludicrous. Now, on top of that, actually, I should have mentioned that in my younger days, in my 20s, I was actually a Marxist socialist.
No, come on. After all that?
Nope. In my 20s. And the reason
after the speech, the spiel you just gave me about the importance of all these things, you started out over there?
Yeah, because my parents were factory workers. And I was concerned for their living, because they were working all the time, slaving away. My friend was anti-capitalist. So you're young and foolish and ignorant. What do you know? Mm-hmm. But I'm glad I did, because I got to learn and understand Marx, and I can see his errors. So I can argue with a communist or a socialist or Marxist, because they're ignorant of what actually happened during that time. But anyways, when I got involved in the investment business, I got in to help people. It wasn't really because of making money. I was really ignorant what I was getting involved into. And then my mentor saw my Marx books and says, have you read Schumpeter? And I said, who the heck is he? Well, he's the opposite side of Marx. Well, I read Schumpeter, and that just opened a can of worms. And then the more I researched and learned, I'm like a full-fledged capitalist. I mean, 100%. I'm not a liberal, libertarian. I've gone the other, only because it's what's best for us, not what we want. We don't like, capitalism is not perfect, but it's the best system. It's created the most amount of wealth. Marx was wrong, and I'm not going to go into why he's wrong. But ultimately, there are some errors that the socialists are missing that I'm going to mention on this show. And you know what? If I could find the chart. So when I looked at Marx, I think it was during the presentation, what I was shocked to discover is during his time, the currency at the time, they were living under sound money, the value of prices or price deflation was occurring throughout his life, and incomes were going up. So that's the benefit of a sound monetary system. And that was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Now, Marx was complaining about a lot of that wealth was going to the top, but Schumpeter corrected and saw that each down wave, it wipes out the elite. It wipes out those who are wealthy, and then a new elite emerges. So if you're a Marxist or socialist, I beg you to take a look at when he was alive and look at the real wages of those in Britain or the UK at the time, and look at the price. You saw consistent deflation throughout his whole life. Mm. So I put a chart, and that is how Britain rose to power. They were creating this huge, they were bringing mass amount of people out of poverty. Today, and what Bitcoin is trying to address, is that currency debasement. We're seeing the erosion of wealth of the lower class, and now we're going to bankrupt the middle class because people have gone into debt to make up the loss of their purchasing power because their incomes since 1984 in real terms have been stagnant. Mm. Now I'll tell you how bad that is. I was a busboy in 1976. And one of my favorite jobs, I used to love that job and it was fun. And but anyways, I won't get into the details of why it was fun. But what's interesting, in real terms, if you live in Toronto, your income has gone nowhere in real terms. So you're no better off than you were in 1966 than you are today in terms of, and that's the problem with currency depreciation. Right. So what have people have done? And if you think about what you don't know, the price of a home was 2 to 3 times income. In Toronto now, it's about 18 times. And how is that possible mathematically? It's simply because of the leverage and the price of credit has fallen, which has allowed Ponzi finance. Now, it's so bad in Toronto that you have to get a 50% drop for prices to catch up or fall back to what they were in 1989 when I bought at the top. That's how ridiculous prices are. And they will in time. You can ask me why in detail, but if you like. But I wanted to make those points because I believe Marx, when he was alive, and if you look at the price, the value of the currency was actually rising and real wages were rising. That's what created the Industrial Revolution and brought people out of abject poverty.
You are quite the historian, Joe. That's good stuff I had never heard before, especially about the sort of standard of living and currency stability, I guess, under Marx. Now, I will ask you about housing and the drop. You know, a little inside baseball here. My house that I'm living in now, I just sold for twice what I paid about 6 years ago. So I know all too well the difference in the housing market from year to year and sort of decade to decade. And one of the reasons, and this is, you know, sort of in the same vein as something else you mentioned that we've also talked about here on our show, the social disruption piece, the social uprising piece, this idea that, you know, there's only so many kicks to the teeth that the average person can take before they've had enough. You know, if you continue to bail out banks, well, another tent encampment shows up somewhere on the Hamilton Mountain or somewhere in, you know, Queen's Park, people are not going to accept that. And the reason I want to talk specifically about the uprising piece with the housing piece is because I don't think a lot of Canadians realize how exposed the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board is to real estate in Canada. I have some numbers here, though I'm not sure how good they are because they do a pretty good job obfuscating their exposure, probably higher now than this. This is from 2019, I believe, or 2020. About 40%. About 24% of what they call their real assets, which is real estate, renewable energy, laughable, and infrastructure, was, you know, that's a quarter of the pension plan. We have this expanding population, shrinking tax base, and as you mentioned there, this kind of decentralized revolution where tax receipts are going to be more and more difficult to come by short of extreme measures from governments. Is this something that your model talks about, this idea that all these things really work together and that potentially any one of those, whether it's the real estate collapsing, whether it's pensions having a problem, whether it's immigration suffering, productivity, as you mentioned, is already stagnated. These things could all potentially be the straw that breaks the camel's back, but they also are the straw that breaks the back of the other. This is a huge problem. Surely your model accounts for that. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I take everything into account. One of the things when I didn't take into account, like a lot of people think I don't like the feedback or the attack. Most of the time, I'm being honest here. Most of the time people are ignorant and they think they know what they're talking about. And they always, I mean, they came back to immigration. So what I did was I looked back and said, well, I've got the data going back to 1850. And if you see my charts, they're very long dated. They're not a favorite piece. Like
if you're on YouTube, Joe's channel, The Economic Long Wave, has long form stuff, including the conference presentation. So if you're on audio, go over to YouTube, check it out, subscribe. The charts are all there and on your Twitter feed as well. Anyway, sorry, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm actually planning to do a lot of videos going forward. I realize the limitations I have on Twitter. So probably by Monday, I'll be doing 5-10 minute videos every day because I can articulate. This is my strength. Writing isn't. And I can present factual data and show and explain the models. But you have to take into account everything. And one of the things I didn't take into account was immigration. So when I had that thrown in my face, so to speak, so I looked at the data. I've got 200 years of data. Again, it's just curious. I'm just curious, right? That's the only thing. I'm just like every other person. I'm just more curious than most. So I looked at it and I was shocked. There was no correlation. And by the way, I had another insight this morning. I was shocked. So a person who saw my chart, I forwarded. So I'm starting to now show people, look, here's what I posted 2 years ago. This is the same charts and I haven't changed them. And I said, well, the millennials will peak next year. The baby boomers peaked in 1991. Now, this chart goes all the way back to 1850. And it was hard to put together because I had to go to Stats Canada and it's just a mess there. And define all that data, splice it, put it together. And then I would ask real estate agents, okay, what is the peak new buying power? And they said 29 is the average age, 30 to 34. Pretty much most people bought their first home. Now, I know that's a little bit different. So I put together the data and I was shocked that it wasn't exact, but it picked 91 as the peak for the baby boomers. And the other one peaks in 2024. And what's amazing, the collapse in the 90s where real estate went nowhere, worked out. The other thing is the collapse, what it says after 2024, the demand's going to collapse into the 2030s, and we're going to have a long secular bear market. The other thing I have in there is actually the exponential rise in the baby boomers who are dying. And that's going to put a huge supply, and that's what happened in Japan. But I looked at immigration, and it had zero correlation because it's affordability. Real estate is driven by affordability. You know, how was my father able to purchase a home in the 50s just based on his income and a factory worker, where today you have to be a millionaire to buy a home in Toronto? And it's leverage. Now, the thing, the epiphany, I can't believe I missed it. I said, wait a sec here. How was it in the 1930s? Because I have the data and I have the chart. So I updated the chart today. How was it in the 1870s, 1880s, the Great Depression and the Long Depression? And we saw a rise in demand. We saw 30 to 34-year-olds where it was going up over here. There was no waves like in 91 because demographics changed in 71. It was when the birth rate started falling below the replacement rate. So we've always seen an exponential rise in the number of 30 to 34-year-olds. And that changed after the baby boom and then the millennial boom. So if you say that if there's rise in demand, you would think prices would go higher, but we had prices collapse in the 1930s. And I'll present it tomorrow. And they also collapse in the 1880s, 1890s. Because when you get a credit collapse, it has nothing to do with how many people could buy. It's what happened before real estate collapse or real estate collapse. It's a massive rise in assets. When it starts to fall, then the psychology, like all asset bubbles are a confidence game. So what I did with the models, I said, okay, here's a real estate bubble. We have to wait for it to peak. And then it follows a process when it unwinds, right? And there's 20 points. We're already at number 7. Number 8 will be when the remaining bulls panic and when they say, oh, this is a real bear market. Now, think about this. And I actually was speaking to somebody else before we started this. We're already seeing the banks pull in their lending. Mm-hmm. If you have the banks pull in their lending, and prices are going lower, then the buyers are going to retrench. And that's what causes a credit collapse. It's the lenders become cautious and the buyers become cautious. So as the economy worsens, the lenders say, okay, we're not going to provide as many loans. We've got to protect our balance sheet. So they've gone from greed to fear, and so is the public. That's how you get a credit collapse. But it has to be predicated on an asset bubble. Okay, how do we know it's an asset bubble? From 1946 until 1981, interest rates were on a secular rise. There was no real estate collapse. So what's the problem with rise in interest rates, right? The reason it never collapsed because we had rising real incomes along with rising inflation and rising asset prices. So there was never going to be a bubble. But the key is, from a long wave, is that asset prices since 96 have not risen because of incomes or inflation. They have risen because of credit inflation. And that's what's caused it to be out of line, out of this historical levels, whether it's incomes or inflation. John Templeton told me the long-term average for real estate is around the inflation rate, and it cycles in and around the inflation. So I did a chart, I think people seen it, and I put real estate prices in Canada, inflation, and incomes. And it's way out of whack.
Yeah.
So you say, how is that possible? Okay, simple. Think of it. So where's my phone here? This thing here, I was one of the first to buy a car phone in 87, and then it became a cell phone. And now everybody has one. Why? Because the price became cheaper over time. And of course, it's technology and it got better. So if you want to know the technology that's going to rock your world in the future, look at its price. And is it falling faster than incomes? And it's usually deflationary, and that increases adoption rate. So now take that thesis and think about real estate or the banks. What did the banks have from 1981, when interest rates peaked, until 2021? A secular fall in the price of credit. Mm-hmm. So naturally, anything tied to the fire industry did well. That's over.
Fire is financials, insurance, and real estate for people who aren't sure. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And so that's why I'm bearish on the whole industry. I believe that, I know for sure that whole industry is going to contract at least 25% to 50%. We have too much finance.
But Joe, what happens then? I mean, if you think about the way that, the CPP, for example, people who are on fixed incomes, they're not keeping up with inflation. And so part of the Canada Pension Plan, sort of unofficially, is the real estate downsize, right? It's the transfer of your home to some, it's the boomer to the millennial, right? That's what we've seen. I bought this home from a boomer and I just sold this home to someone even younger than me. And the cycle continues. And at the top of that food chain is the sort of, retiree who wants to continue to live a decent lifestyle for longer than they've ever had to, by the way. When the CPP was formed, they probably thought people would die at 65. Now they're living to 100 and going to Aquafit every Saturday, right? It's a different ball game. And so, what happens, Joe, if those markets collapse, well, what are those people going to do? That's the thing that's going to send people in the street. This is a concern that I have, and I'm not, particularly prone to lighting torches, but I know some people who are. They're not going to wait for this thing to get better. They're going to start to get mad if they haven't already. And so what are we to do, what are we to expect in your view as the straw that eventually breaks that sort of real estate, that secondary income, that secondary option for you to kind of continue your retirement? I see in Canada now, they're, RBC famously, or infamously, I guess, over the last few days, issuing 60, 70, 80, and 90 year AM on mortgages.
Right.
So, are we going to have people not retire? Are we going to have generational homes? Like what is next here, man? What do you think?
Well, the lesson that society forgot was don't deregulate the fire industry, their finance industry. Let me say finance, right? So I say fire, as Joey said, finance, insurance, and real estate. We made that mistake. When I started the investment business, if you want to buy a mutual fund and it went to the bank, they'd say, well, that's too risky. Go over there. And it was Investors Group. That's where I started. Most people, Investors Group's been around a long time. I started out West. It's a great training background. Well, after the real estate collapse in the early 90s, we saw the banks get involved in the investment business, and they started licensing tellers and all that. And we complained because they were overstepping, and it's still happening, where they're saying, oh, if you come over here and bring your assets, we have mutual funds too. We give you a discount on a mortgage, discount on a credit card. And we knew this was a conflict of interest. And today, I'm glad I'm not in the business directly. I will go back in a different form, but not as an advisor. What I'm doing now is much more gratifying. There's just collusion. And it's a product. They're selling product instead of wealth management. And wealth management is protecting your capital. Whether you use technical analysis or you're a value investor, the first rule is not to lose money. You know, Warren Buffett, what does he have? $134 billion in cash? Now that tells you something. And if I talk to people with their portfolio, how much cash do you have in your portfolio? And it'd be next to nothing.
Yeah.
Where if I, you know, my own model that people are subscribing to, we're about 50% cash simply because a couple things here. So there's a conflict of interest. First of all, I have to make people aware that wealth management is one thing, is protecting your capital. The second thing is not overpaying for assets. That's what I've learned throughout this whole 35 years of studying the market, where my ignorance was more concerned about buying a home in 89 and realizing I was just overpaying for it. And if I would have been younger or older and waited 5 years later, and my partner at the time just was 5 years younger, he bought at the absolute bottom. So if you talk to him about real estate, his view about real estate is totally different than my own. Now, to answer your question, I wasn't trying to avoid it, but what can you do when you financialize the economy? What can you do when you go onto a fiat monetary system, right? This is not capitalism anymore. That died in 71. It's Richard Duncan calls it creditism, which is an exponential rise in credit and consumption. And we're hitting that wall next year. Now, what can you do? The solutions are easy. To implement them, they're really hard. We know one thing for sure. We're going on to a sound monetary system. There's a great book called the Great Wave. It has nothing to do with the long wave. That great wave goes, there's data going back to 1200. And it shows we go through centuries of fiat, monetary debasement, and then sound money. And then we switch. So we had that 100 years of monetary debasement. Now we're switching to a sound. And gold, Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies are part of it, right? That's inevitable. But what do you do? Well, if all you, here's a hard, let me step back. What can you do when society makes a mistake? Where we didn't learn from history. We have this technological prowess that's unbelievable, like the genomic revolution, stem cell revolution. Oh my God, it's like, that's game changer. But we overblew assets. The governments are going to be defaulting in 5 years. That's why I don't have any allocation of bonds. Real estate's going to collapse. So the only thing I've realized, and I've been thinking about this almost for 10 years because I knew it was going to end badly, but honestly, I didn't forecast that we would leverage from zero. I mean, that's absolutely insane. I'm a historian. There's no historical precedent for that. All you can do, what I've come to a conclusion and why I've launched what I'm doing, is to help people protect themselves and get through economic winter. We all care about other people, but if they destroy the system that no longer can work, then you know what their solution is. It's Klaus Schwab, you will own nothing, guaranteed basic income, controlling, right? That's what all this is about. It's their solution to the collapse. They're totally aware of it. Now, I've said numerous times it's going to fail because the public won't accept it. I believe on the other side of this mess that we'll probably be working most of our lives because we'll be productive, we'll be healthy. Genomic stem cell is going to transform. We're not going to have disability in 30 years. So there's a lot of good news. But honestly, we're at a point we can't think about everybody. We can only think about ourselves and our family and how to protect them. Because we've just created the greatest credit bubble in history. And I think if you see my charts, Canada's private debt to GDP is larger than Japan's in 89, which is bigger than the US in 1929. And those ended badly. The only good news is because we don't have, the workforce is falling relative to the size of the population, hopefully most people will keep their jobs. And if they do that, their assets will be a lot cheaper. Everything will be cheaper. My only solution is for real estate is when people get into trouble, restructure the debt. And I think that people who bought homes in the past 5-10 years, we're going to have to restructure the debt. We can't put them on the street. What's that?
I'm pointing to myself here. Just bought another house. Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate that.
Oh, okay. Well.
Listen, I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that short of being prepared and to your point, having some percentage of portfolio in dry powder, whether it is to weather a difficult period or to take advantage of the deals that you've, you know, and your clients have been successful so far in waiting out, I think it's important. And, you know, I kind of laugh. And I know a lot of people dismiss the Klaus Schwab thing. And I don't know, like that guy kind of is like a perfect comic book villain, honestly. But when people dismiss this idea of, you know, this will never happen, not that you're doing this, you think it'll be attempted at least, but rebuked. I always suggest people the same thing. You know, in the world of you will own nothing and be happy, what about that seems so implausible to you? You probably don't own your cell phone. You're probably on like a 2-year payment plan. You don't own your house. You don't own your car. You don't own the land your house is on. Your job is tenuous. What can you really hold and claim ownership of 100% with no counterparty risk? It's nothing. The money in the bank is not yours. The stock portfolio is not yours. None of it is yours. That's why Bitcoin, I think, to a lot of people is important. Now, I want to ask you about Bitcoin, since after all, this is a Bitcoin show. And after all, you did get a Bitcoin conference. Now, I'm curious, where do you think this fits in? Because it sounds to me like you're concerned about, and I know you're concerned about this from other content you've done, about what will modern governments do to keep the people from leaving, from revolting, from amassing capital. I've heard you talk about real estate, potential real estate seizure, potential gold seizure, potential Bitcoin seizure. Where does this thing fit for you? I mean, you have some allocation Bitcoin? To it. You don't have to tell me how much. Yeah, Bitcoin. I mean, where does it fit for you in the 10-year, the 30-year? Is it something that when you talk about the waves of currency, is this part of a potential sound currency future? It sounds like you think it is. How much of a part? I think a lot of people disagree with you, and for sure me, about that. So where do you think it fits?
Well, I'm always skeptical about technology because I have two hats. My original hat was saw these asset bubbles as a value manager and realized the risk of those things were going to implode. When I studied the long waves, I was like, oh, these technology booms are a sign of innovation and they're game changers. What I mean by that, if you go back through each mania throughout history, the NASDAQ was good. We had 3D printing bubble. We had now we're having robotics bubble. Before that, renewable energy. We've had two bubbles in that. Technology, cell phones, go back in the 20s, automobiles, radio. Railroads in the 1870s. Why is my mind blank? Anyways, they're a sign of progress. So that's an exciting part. We know that when we see an asset bubble, now it's an artificial intelligence, that this is a game changer and it's going to rock our world. So this is one thing I know for sure, that we've had these bubbles in Bitcoin, but it's a sign of progress, right? There's creative destruction. We're fixing all the mistakes and the problems. But it's going to be part of the future. That I can say with confidence. That's the advantage of a long wave. Canal mania. That's what I couldn't remember. The canal mania in the 1830s. So there's manias. And we're throwing all this capital, as we're doing now with even the cryptocurrencies. And we don't know who's going to win because, you know, it's a system. Like, for example, the automobiles, there was 1,000 companies in 1920. And there was only 100 left by 1930, and today there's maybe 10 worldwide, right? You have this consolidation as each one, whatever. So with Bitcoin and this decentralized, you see that it's going to be the form of money. There's no conflict with the gold crowd. I believe gold provides the anchor to get us to the other side because it's a confidence game. When the system collapses, gold will be the confidence to tie the system, and then Bitcoin would be the money that people will be using. So, and I suggest people to allocate to both. Now, I'm glad I went to the conference because I met Lawrence Lepard and Greg Foss, and I'm glad they gave me a thumbs up to the seminar, because you can't fool these guys if you don't know what you're talking about, even though my slides were
a little out of order. That was the AV guy's fault, KJ. I know. Trust me, I was making the sausage, man. Not you, not them. The AV guys.
You know what? It's okay, because you know what? I know my stuff, and I just knew what I had to convey, that the Kondratos fifth wave is decentralized. It's the empowerment of the individual to technology. It is not the empowerment of a psychopath who wants to control you and tell you what to do with your life. All I know, I don't know where you live, but I know in this city here, we're going to overthrow the government if they do that. Look, you're not going to take our stuff. Are you kidding me? I mean, this is why I call them psychopaths. I mean, they're psychopaths because they don't understand human nature. And the Kondratov cycle, it's a social cycle, is reflective of society. It's what the masses want. And the masses are going to want freedom. They're going to want wealth, and they're wanting independence. With all these converging technologies, we don't need government anymore. Let me rephrase that. We don't need this big government anymore. Mm-hmm. It's inefficient. Artificial intelligence is going to collapse the size of the government, and we have to make it smaller. Like, there's two industries that will collapse. One is government. It will have to shrink 20 to 25, 50%, and so is the fire industry, because it's dependent on inflation. Bitcoin technologies thrive under deflation. And so it's just, that's why it's so disruptive. So it's this old system that crumbles, and then we have this emerging one because of technology that drives it. And it's empowering you. It doesn't empower Klaus Schwab. I mean, we really don't need even the prime minister anymore. Let me tell you how far I think this is going to go. I don't even believe elected representation is going to survive the next 20 years. I think we're going toward a direct democracy because of blockchain technology.
Yeah, right? They call it a vote, vote that floats, right? You can change your thing anytime you want. If you don't like what you see, switch it. There's no elections anymore, no cycles. It's day to day.
And we should have a vote on that. So again, and it's this collective change that is coming. I just believe that, and I agree. I don't know if people heard of Martin Armstrong. I agree with him where he says that.
Marty is a favorite of mine. I would love for him to come on the show. I'm glad you brought him up.
Oh, yeah, he's fabulous. I subscribe to his service. And he, you know, if you talk to anybody, they all give a tip of hat to Kondratov, Martin Armstrong to Robert Prechter, Neil Howe from The Fourth Turning, The Cyclum Cycle. Wow. They all mention Kondratov because he's the one that discovered cycles, and because that's how energy moves through a medium. Once you understand that, you know, every other theory of economics doesn't make sense. And I don't even pay attention to it anymore, because once you understand that, it's easy to forecast. It's very easy to forecast. You just look at the world differently. And socioeconomics also talks about that. So I don't know where I'm going here with this, but basically is Bitcoin is inevitable. The decentralized currencies are inevitable, 100%, because of this creative destruction.
What is after? I mean, the cycle presumably repeats, hence the name. I mean, so what? I mean, this is maybe too deep a question for 10 minutes here, but you know, what does the cycle think about following a decentralized sound money? We've had sound money before, right? We've talked about this sort of fiat to sound money change. We've talked about the governments rising and falling and empires rising and falling. Dalio, Kondratov, all these other, you know, these names over the years that have said similar things, but never in a world that's so instant, so digital, where information sharing is so, you know, readily available. Is there no precedent for this? So presumably, you know, you're going to continue to be a student of the long wave theory. What does the long wave say about, you know, after the next kind of, I don't want to call it a reset for fear of upsetting Klaus, but you know, after the next reset, what do they say? What do you think?
Oh, I didn't realize, you know, this is my ignorance, so I apologize for that. I didn't realize you've read Ray Dalio. I'm constantly reading, and Ray Dalio, I think, is one of those elite or wealthy people that have provided in his books a look at the past. And yeah. I tell you, his book is The World Changing Order. It's a fantastic book. It's an addition to The Long Wave. And my favorite now also this year is the one, A Theory of Interest. And they talk about how interest rates are important. But look, change is inevitable. Where The Long Wave and these other theories, where technology forecasters are wrong, we have to get to creative destruction first, and then the technology booms. You have to have the old system not work anymore, so it has to collapse. Recessions and depressions are cleansing periods. The people who are living through it don't like it, but they are necessary for humanity's evolutionary move forward, right? And just like in this is a cycle of life, we don't want to die, we don't want to age, but it's part of humanity's marching forward. Kondratiev discovered the cyclicality of capitalism, and it's called evolutionary economics in simplicity. It's not these fixed ideas about economics and more money and printing is going to solve a problem. No, what's going to solve the problem is the old system collapses and this new monetary system emerging and these technologies. Once we can't go to the doctor and the sick care system is not sustainable, we're aging and there's a diabetes epidemic. So, but there's emerging technologies. And we're, if you look at in the field, I want to make sure I make this point here. We look at Canada, we have the people, we have the technology, we have the resources. Mm-hmm. We just don't have the politicians. Our current crop of politicians are putting brakes on the economy. You want to see Canada boom, have the greatest economic boom in history? We have to get rid of these politicians. They're ignorant, and they bought into this, CO2 is a pollutant and climate change is going to wipe humanity off this earth. I mean, it took me 6 months to figure out IPCC is a political organization. They're not a climate organization. And there's three prominent Canadian climate scientists that educated me on the reality of all this. Now, saying all that, I'm a huge fan of renewable energy because solar and wind and decentralized nuclear power are game changers. But technology, it must come from itself. What governments are doing are destruction creation. They're trying to destroy the old system, which is going to cause massive poverty. And that's why it's going to fail. If you want to switch to electric, then start building these small-scale nuclear and let the prices fall. And then when it becomes cheap enough, you know, like the cell phone, I switched because it was better than using my home phone. It was more convenient. But if you made my home phone more expensive to force me to buy something that I wasn't ready for, I wouldn't have purchased this phone. So the same thing happens with energy. It has to come from itself. And that's why it's going to fail too.
I like that take. Now, Joel, you and I were talking in DMs when I invited John about a week ago, and you mentioned something at the conference that I want to talk about here. You came on second half of the day to finish up some of the points you wanted to make, and you told the men in the audience to get their testosterone checked. Okay, yeah. Now I appreciated that comment. As I mentioned, I'm an elder millennial. I'm 35, and I can see slowly for people in the crowd. I've been talking a lot of shit on this podcast over the last 2 years about my physical prowess. Slowly, okay, some of the edge is starting to come off. And I know that there's been incidences of people recovering from injury with TRT. I know a couple of guys who are a little older than me who are on TRT for mental illness. And if you are willing, I would love to hear the story of your injury and recovery. I think it's related to testosterone. I'd be curious to hear exactly what happened, if you're willing to share.
Yeah, of course. I left the business in 2012, and I thought I was depressed because I saw a systemic economic collapse coming. And I didn't realize at the time, I just wandered through the decade. I just was lost. I gave up on life. I didn't care. I gained about 40, 50 pounds. And I went to doctors. I went to so many doctors. And then I went to a hormone doctor and then endocrinologist. And I remember getting the results back. Oh, let me say, Yeah, I remember. Oh, no, this is another. I went to see a doctor and there was something out of line, my hormones. She never alerted me to it. Then I went to my doctor and I said, look, my sister, my family is complaining that something's wrong with me. I just became a nobody and become irresponsible. I just didn't care. I let my finances go, let my life go, and I didn't do anything. And I went to my doctor and got a physical, and he said, let me check your blood work. And then I looked at it and I said, hey, this is the second time I saw my prolactin is high. He goes, that's happened before. So make a long story short, she sent me to an endocrinologist, and she got me to do an MRI because they thought I had a tumor, and there's no tumor. And she said, well, you know, Mr. Barbuto, your testosterone is low, your prolactin's high. But, you know, and I remember sitting back and saying, well, I feel like crap and I don't care about life. Like, I don't care. I people call me lazy. I don't really care. So I just left and said, oh, well, and was eating. What kept me alive, by the way, I told the story, is I was taking care of my father who had dementia. He was suffering dementia. And I think that's what kept me alive. I realized he'd lived and stayed and I took care of him. That's what kept me, because my sister said, if I wasn't taking care of my father, I probably wouldn't be alive today, which is true. And I was watching a Joe Rogan podcast and I heard some guys talking about traumatic brain injury. I said, well, that sounds like me. I said, I have all these symptoms. So I looked up if there were any doctors and I found Dr. Comer here in Ontario. And it took 6 months to see him. By the way, it takes 2 years to see him now. And yeah, so busy. And he did the test at a zillion questions, some strange and funny ones. And when he saw me, he goes, I don't know what's wrong with the system, but do you have classic, hormone levels are low and because of your viral meningitis I had in the 20s and it caught up to you in your 50s.
Hmm.
So he put me on testosterone replacement therapy and also cabergoline to bring my prolactin. And I started training and next time I'll show you pictures, but I have before and after. And I went from the best shape of my life. I lost 50 pounds, gym. I'm cut and lean. I've never been this great shape. And I feel like I'm 25. Now, the reason why I said you should get your levels, so you know what they're all. I don't know what my levels were in my 30s, 40s, or 50s, early 50s. Up until that point, but you know, there's a baseline and you want to delay going on it as long as possible because you're going to be on it the rest of your life. And I'm cautious about suggesting to anybody under 40 to go on it, especially if you haven't had kids yet or plan to have a family, because it does affect things. But what it did is, and by the way, if you check my levels and everybody thinks I'm jacked or like, RFK, because,
is there a shirtless video coming out or what? When can I expect to see that on the channel?
Yeah, you know what? Like I said, you still have to work out. You can have, look, in your 20s, your testosterone's through the roof, but you could still be fat and obese. You got to train. You have to eat right. You have to work out. I mean, everybody, that guy's on roids, man. So it won't do anything if you don't work out hard. You still got to put in the effort and vitamins and diet and training. I mean, it goes with the terror. All it does is, my levels are at a normal high level. And if you see my blood work, you would know I'm on it. It's simply to keep me, myself as a male, and optimal, because I want to be optimal. I have a new lease on life. I'm a fighter again in a good way. And it just gives me a quality life. You just can't get anything else. So that's the story. It's really the younger you are, know what your levels are. And if you start feeling anything, you're not doing something right. I mean, I first would say diet, exercise, lose weight, watch what you eat and all that. And then it's the last thing. And if you have to go on it for other reasons, you do, but it's a game changer. And we see Robert Kennedy, this guy's 69, look at him, but he's still training like a madman, and he's on a diet and he said he's on time restricted feeding and all that. So I'm always laughing when people say, oh, the guy's on roids, man. So what? Doesn't do anything. Like a 22. Have you not seen that obese, out of shape 22-year-old who's full of testosterone?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course. So
it's funny. Like I appreciate that story because I think there is a stigma around TRT. There's a stigma around seeing doctors, especially for men. You know, it's not just about the TRT. Think about the lead up to that visit, right? You know, you've seen all these doctors, something's wrong. You know, something's wrong. Other people are saying something's wrong. How many men would just, you know, give them one of those and go, you don't like it, don't come over. No, you don't like it, don't see me. You don't like it, don't call me. But for you to have the self-awareness to do that, I think is important. And one of the things we talk about on the show, Joe, a lot, and we've kind of touched on it and danced around it a bit tonight too, is that the problem as the collapse accelerates, you know, it's not just that you're going to have a hard time buying groceries and be, you know, waiting for your next grocery stimmy check and the TikTok video to go with it. It's that the bandwidth that you have to understand things and the emotional kind of balance you need to sit down and read something that's important to your well-being or your family's well-being, it starts to evaporate. And when it evaporates, the frustration grows, and that flywheel will kill people if they don't know how to seek help. And so I'm glad to hear that story. That's really good stuff. Now, before you go, last question, you're an Italian guy. I'm an Italian guy. I don't know if you're a soccer guy or not. I want to know, have you been more disgraced than last World Cup when Italy didn't make it? Or was there a time you felt more disgraced as an Italian?
Man, I still have downstairs when they won the cup in 82. I tell you, man, it was the best time in my life when they won. It's the best memories ever. And of course you're ticked off as an Italian. You know, when they won, I got to tell you the story quickly. When they won, I used to live at Jane and Wilson, if everybody knows where Toronto is. And so we started to walk right down Jane Street, and it was other cultures, and as the Black community was actually nearby, they would come down with us and all that. And it was a party, best party I ever had in my life. I still remember vividly. It was like a party. And to just want to repeat that is so rare. Yeah. Yeah. You get frustrated. You go, oh, I missed that time, man. Cause that was, you know, those are always great times. Of course, I'm the same way with hockey. I mean, the last time Leafs won the game, my you know, we're watching black and white TV in the basement of our semi-detached home. That's all, you know, I can imagine when the Leafs win a game. So anyways, yeah, I'm with you there. I just don't want to talk about it because it's depressing.
Winning the Euro and then losing, like, to the point where you didn't even get into the World Cup, not 2 years later, a year later, yeah, because of the COVID break. Unbelievable. Okay. Joe, tell people where they can find you. You've been a great guest. The floor's all yours, buddy.
Yeah, thanks. I'm on Twitter, and I just launched a website. It's the Economic Long Wave. You can contact me there if you want to reach out. If you're interested in the model, that's really all I'm providing now. It's just a model. It's a satellite view, and it's only $20 a month, or you can pay $200 a year. And what you get with the model is a guidance where things are going, and it'll give you an allocation. It's the model that I perfected that avoided losses. And it's really a tactical asset allocation model to help guide you with your assets. And you can vary around it, just watch it shine. This is what it's good at. And if you want to be educated too, the website and Twitter account is an education of the long way. So that's where you can reach me. If that interests you, yeah, I'd love to have you as a client.
Outstanding. Thanks for listening, watching, everybody. Take care of yourselves. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Joey. Bye, everyone.
Great job, Joe.